Section 2, A New Constitution, An American Story. As Benjamin Franklin arrived at the Pennsylvania State House on September 17, 1787, he rejoiced with his colleagues about the freshness of the morning air. For 16 weeks, the 81-year-old Franklin had made the short journey from his home just off Market Street to the State House. There, delegates to the Constitutional Convention had exhaustively debated the future of the nation. Today, they would have a chance to sign a draft plan for the nation's new constitution. When it came Franklin's turn to sign, the elderly leader had to be helped forward in order to write his name on the parchment. Tears streamed down his face as he signed. When the remaining delegates had finished signing, a solemn silence enveloped the hall. Franklin relieved the tension with a few well-chosen words. Pointing to the half-sun painted in gold on the back of George Washington's chair, he observed, "I have often looked at that sun behind the president of the convention without being able to tell whether it was rising or setting. But now at length I have the happiness to know it is a rising and not a setting sun." Quoted in An Outline of American History. The Constitutional Convention. The weakness of the Confederation Congress worried many American leaders who believed that the United States would not survive without a strong central government. People who supported a stronger central government became known as nationalists. Prominent nationalists included George Washington, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, Alexander Hamilton, and the financier Robert Morris. One of the most influential nationalists was James Madison, a member of the Virginia Assembly and head of its Commerce Committee. As head of the Commerce Committee, Madison was well aware of Virginia's trade problems with the other American states and with Britain. He firmly believed that a stronger national government was needed. In 1786, Madison convinced Virginia's Assembly to call a convention of all the states to discuss trade and taxation problems. Representatives from the states were to meet in Annapolis, Maryland, but when the convention began, delegates from only 5 states were present, too few to reach a final decision on the problems facing the states. Many of the delegates did discuss the weakness of the Articles of Confederation and expressed interest in modifying them. New York delegate Alexander Hamilton recommended that the Congress itself call for another convention to be held in Philadelphia in May 1787. At first, the Congress was divided over whether or not to call a convention. News of Shays' rebellion, however, and reports of unrest elsewhere convinced the Congress to call for a convention of the states for the sole purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation. Every state except Rhode Island sent delegates to what became known as the Constitutional Convention. In May 1787, the delegates took their places in the Pennsylvania State House in Philadelphia. They knew they faced a daunting task, to balance the rights and aspirations of the states with the need for a stronger national government. The Founders. The 55 delegates who attended the convention in Philadelphia included some of the shrewdest and most distinguished leaders in the United States. The majority were lawyers, and most of the others were planters and merchants. Most had experience in colonial, state, or national government. 7 had served as state governors. 39 had been members of the Confederation Congress. 8 had signed the Declaration of Independence. In the words of Thomas Jefferson, who was unable to attend the convention because he was serving as American minister to France, the convention in Philadelphia was no less than an assembly of demigods. The delegates chose stern and proper George Washington of Virginia, hero of the American Revolution, as presiding officer. Benjamin Franklin was a delegate from Pennsylvania. Now 81 years old, he tired easily and had other state delegates read his speeches for him. He provided assistance to many of his younger colleagues, and his experience and good humor helped smooth the debates. Other notable delegates included New York's Alexander Hamilton and Connecticut's Roger Sherman. Virginia sent a well-prepared delegation, including the scholarly James Madison, who kept a record of the debates. Madison's records provide the best source of information about what went on in the sessions. The meetings were closed to the public to help ensure honest and open discussion, free from outside political pressures. The Virginia and New Jersey plans. The Virginia delegation arrived at the convention with a detailed plan, mostly the work of James Madison, for a new national government. A few days after the proceedings began, the governor of Virginia, Edmund Randolph, introduced the plan. A national government, declared Randolph, ought to be established, consisting of a supreme legislative, executive, and judiciary. The Virginia Plan, as it came to be called, proposed scrapping the Articles of Confederation entirely and creating a new national government with the power to make laws binding upon the states and to raise its own money through taxes. The Virginia Plan proposed that the legislature be divided into two houses. The voters in each state would elect members of the first house. Members of the second house would be nominated by the state governments, but actually elected by the first house. In both houses, the number of representatives for each state would reflect that state's population. The Virginia Plan, therefore, would benefit large states like Virginia, New York, and Massachusetts, which had more votes than the smaller states. The Virginia Plan drew sharp reactions. The delegates accepted the idea of dividing the government into executive, legislative, and judicial branches, but the smaller states strongly opposed any changes that would decrease their influence by basing representation on population. They feared that the larger states would outvote them. William Patterson, a delegate from New Jersey, offered a counterproposal that came to be called the New Jersey Plan. The New Jersey Plan did not abandon the Articles of Confederation. Instead, it modified them to make the central government stronger. Under the plan, Congress would have a single house in which each state was equally represented, but it would also have the power to raise taxes and regulate trade. If progress was to be made, the delegates had to choose one plan for further negotiation. After debating on June 19th, the convention voted to proceed with the Virginia Plan. With this vote, the convention delegates decided to go beyond their original purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation. Instead, they began to work on a new constitution for the United States. Reading check. Explaining, why did small states oppose the Virginia Plan? A union built on compromise. As the convention hammered out the details of the new constitution, the delegates found themselves divided geographically. The small states demanded changes that would protect them against the voting power of the big states. At the same time, northern and southern states were divided over how to treat slavery in the new constitution. The only way to resolve these differences was through compromise. Turning point. The Connecticut Compromise. After the convention voted to proceed with the Virginia Plan, tempers flared as delegates from the small states insisted that each state had to have an equal vote in Congress. The hot Philadelphia summer offered no relief, and angry delegates from the larger states threatened to walk out. By early July 1787, the convention had reached a turning point. As a delegate from North Carolina warned, if we do not concede on both sides, our business must soon end. In an attempt to find a solution, the convention appointed a special committee to resolve the differences between the large and small states. Delegates who were strongly committed to one side or the other were left off the committee, leaving only those who were undecided or willing to change their minds. Ben Franklin was chosen to chair the proceedings. Throughout the proceedings, Franklin remained a calm voice of conciliation. Here, he warns the delegates about what would happen if they failed to agree. You will become a reproach and byword down to future ages. And what is worse, mankind may hereafter, from this unfortunate instance, despair of establishing governments by human wisdom and leave it to chance, war, and conquest. Quoted in Benjamin Franklin, a biography. The compromise that the committee worked out was based on an idea Roger Sherman of Connecticut proposed, which is why it is sometimes known as the Connecticut Compromise. Other historians refer to it as the Great Compromise. Franklin's committee proposed that in one house of Congress, the House of Representatives, the states would be represented according to the size of their populations. In the other house, the Senate, each state would have equal representation. The eligible voters in each state would elect the House of Representatives, but the state legislatures would choose senators. Compromise over slavery. Franklin's committee also proposed that each state could elect one member to the House of Representatives for every 40,000 people in the state. This proposal caused a split between Northern and Southern delegates. Southern delegates wanted to count enslaved people when determining how many representatives they could elect. Northern delegates' objective pointed out that enslaved people could not vote. Northern delegates also suggested that if slaves were going to be counted for representation, they should be counted for purposes of taxation as well. In the end, a solution, referred to as the Three-Fifths Compromise, was worked out. Every 5 enslaved people in a state would count as 3 free persons for determining both representation and taxes. The dispute over how to count enslaved people was not the only issue dividing the delegates. Southerners feared that a strong national government with the power to regulate trade might impose taxes on the export of farm products or ban the import of enslaved Africans. These Southern delegates insisted that the new Constitution forbid interference with the slave trade and limit Congress's power to regulate trade. Northern delegates, on the other hand, knew that Northern merchants and artisans needed a government capable of controlling foreign imports into the United States. Eventually, another compromise was worked out. The delegates agreed that the new Congress could not tax exports. They also agreed that it could not ban the slave trade until 1808 or impose high taxes on the import of enslaved persons. The Great Compromise and the compromises between Northern and Southern delegates ended most of the major disputes between the state delegations. This enabled the convention to focus on the details of how the new government would operate. By mid-September, the delegates had completed their task. Although everyone had had to compromise, the 39 delegates who signed the new Constitution believed it was a vast improvement over the Articles of Confederation. On September 20th, they sent it to the Confederation Congress for approval. 8 days later, the Congress voted to submit the Constitution to the states for approval. The struggle for the Constitution now moved into a new phase. 9 of the 13 states had to ratify the Constitution for it to take effect. Reading check. Describing, how did the South want to count enslaved persons when counting the population of the states? A framework for limited government. The new constitution that the states were considering was based on the principle of popular sovereignty, or rule by the people. Rather than a direct democracy, it created a representative system of government in which elected officials represented the voice of the people. The Constitution also created a system of government known as federalism. It divided government power between the federal or national government and the state governments. The Constitution provided for a separation of powers among the 3 branches of the federal government. The 2 houses of Congress made up the legislative branch of the government. They would make the laws. The executive branch, headed by a president, would implement and enforce the laws passed by Congress. The judicial branch, a system of federal courts, would interpret federal laws and render judgment in cases involving those laws. No one serving in one branch could serve in either of the other branches at the same time. Checks and balances. In addition to separating the powers of the government into 3 branches, the delegates of the convention created a system of checks and balances to prevent any one of the 3 branches from becoming too powerful. Within this system, each branch of government had the ability to limit the power of the other branches. Under the Constitution, the president, as head of the executive branch, was given far-reaching powers. The president could propose legislation, appoint judges, put down rebellions, and veto or reject acts of Congress. The president would also be the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. According to one delegate in Philadelphia, these powers might not have been so great had not many of the members cast their eyes towards George Washington as president. Although the president could veto acts of Congress, the legislature could override the veto with a 2/3 vote in both houses. The Senate also had to approve or reject presidential appointments to the executive branch, as well as any treaties the president negotiated. Furthermore, Congress could, if necessary, impeach or formally accuse of misconduct and then remove the president or any other high official in the executive or judicial branch. Members of the judicial branch of government could hear all cases arising under federal law and the Constitution. The powers of the judiciary were balanced by the other two branches. The president could nominate members of the judiciary, but the Senate had to confirm or reject such nominations. Once appointed, however, federal judges would serve for life, thus ensuring their independence from both the executive and the legislative branches. Amending the Constitution. The delegates in Philadelphia recognized that the Constitution they wrote in the summer of 1787 might need to be amended or changed over time. To ensure this could happen, they created a clear system for making amendments or changes to the Constitution. To prevent the government from being changed constantly, they made it difficult for amendments to be adopted. The delegates established a two-step process for amending the Constitution: proposal and ratification. An amendment could be proposed by a vote of two-thirds of the members of both houses of Congress. Alternatively, two-thirds of the states could call a congressional convention to propose new amendments. To become effective, the proposed amendment then had to be ratified by three-fourths of the state legislatures, or by conventions in three-fourths of the states. The success of the Philadelphia Convention in creating a government that reflected the country's many different viewpoints was, in Washington's words, little short of a miracle. The convention, John Adams declared, was the single greatest effort of national deliberation that the world has ever seen. Reading check. Explaining: How is power divided under the system of federalism?